Constitutional Conversations with Dr. David Gray Adler are presented by the Alturas Institute and KISU-FM. Find audio for this and other Constitutional Conversations, complete with question and answer portion of the program, on our website. Visit kisu.org, click on Programs, and find Alturas Institute Events. Tonight we listen back to a program recorded on January 24th of this year, Alturas at the Movies, The Post, The Pentagon Papers, and The Freedom of the Press.
Well, welcome everybody. Thanks for joining us for the beginning of this next series of five constitutional conversations. I'm sorry we don't have anything to talk about, nothing going on in our government, in our nation, but we'll find something. So tonight we're going to begin by talking about this, what promises to be an award-winning film that captures a landmark Supreme Court case, the Pentagon Papers, the most famous, indeed the great landmark Free Press case in American history. I love talking about this case and all of its implications for American constitutional law and democracy, and we'll get into that pretty shortly. Next week, we'll watch the State of the Union address here together. The church will have two big flat-screen TVs here, so we'll watch President Trump. I'll talk about his constitutional views afterward, and then you can all participate through Q&A. So I hope you can do that, and if you do, let's arrive at about 6:45 next week, because the speech starts at 7. We don't know how long President Trump is going to speak, whether it's 3 minutes or 30 minutes, somewhere in between, but we'll certainly enjoy listening to his talk. And we've got, I hope, a really good series. We'll even have a Valentine's special on February 13th, The Constitution and Love. So bring your wives and your girlfriends, your husbands and your boyfriends, and we'll all mix in here very comfortably. I'm excited to tell you that KISU is going to be rebroadcasting tonight's program, and will from now on rebroadcast our programs. And the first rebroadcast will be on February 12th. So we're very happy to have KISU aboard as a sponsor. And I want to thank a number of sponsors: the Carr Foundation, Oppenheimer Incorporated, Channel Blend, Steve and Cindy Carr, and a host of others who have been very generous in supporting the Alturas Institute. And we are 501c3, and so it's important to have that kind of support. At any rate, let's not delay the purpose for why we're here tonight. When we talk about the Pentagon Papers case in 1971, the official name of which is New York Times versus the United States, we're discussing what everybody agrees to be the most important free press case in our entire history, a case where the free press clause was on the line, and in view of many scholars, the entire First Amendment. So we're not talking about something that is unimportant here. And if you have not had a chance to read the case, or you're not familiar with the great history surrounding the case, maybe you've had a chance to see this wonderful movie, The Post. Have any of you gone to see the movie yet? It's, yes, we've got a good number who've seen it, and I encourage others to see it. That's why you're here. We do movie reviews here at the Alturas Institute. You might have been expecting something else, but that's what we do. And it's hard for this movie not to be exceptional. It's a Steven Spielberg movie. Tom Hanks plays the legendary Washington Post editor Ben Bradley. And, of course, Meryl Streep is playing Katharine Graham, the owner and publisher of the Washington Post, who makes the most gutsy decisions. And without giving away the storyline, you'll like the fact that she's a very strong, independent woman who is able to tell men she can handle this on her own. So it's a wonderful story, and I hope you will go see it. It's well done. It presumes a little bit of knowledge about the Pentagon Papers, and if you haven't seen it, I hope you'll acquire that knowledge tonight so that you'll enjoy the movie even more. Our story begins at a cabinet meeting when President Lyndon Johnson was in office in 1965. He asked his cabinet an astounding series of questions. How did the United States become involved in Vietnam? What are we trying to accomplish? What are our goals and objectives? A reasonable question to ask at the beginning of the decision-making process before you go to war, but a strange set of questions to ask after you have just ordered so many bombing missions that the number of bombing missions you've ordered will be greater than all the bombs that have been dropped in all the wars in which the United States has ever been involved. And then you ask, anybody know why we're in Vietnam? A little bit later. So President Johnson tasks his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, to commission a study to address those questions, among others, to try to determine what the United States is doing in Vietnam. McNamara finds a number of very good experts inside Washington, some working with companies that do business with the government, other scholars to participate in this study, known as the Pentagon Papers study. And it will be 47 volumes in length, some 7,000 pages, studded with all kinds of documents and memos addressing these important. President Johnson, as you know, is forced to reach the decision that he will not run for a second term in 1968. His successor, Richard Nixon, may or may not have known about the Pentagon Papers study. He certainly knew of some component parts, but oh boy, he will know about it sooner rather than later. Richard Nixon assumes the presidency, as you know, on January 20, 1969. And it's not too deep into his presidency when he himself has a number of national security questions that he would like to have researched. And so he tasks a few people to look at certain parts of the Pentagon Papers to address those questions. One of those men is named Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg had actually been one of the participating scholars in writing different parts of the Pentagon Papers study. He is at this point in 1969 working with the RAND Corporation, which, as you know, works closely with the American government on a number of national security issues. Ellsberg is given access to the Pentagon Papers. When he begins to read through the thousands of pages, the many pages beyond the scope of his own limited work, he begins to suffer some conscience pangs. His conscience bothers him. It's tugging and pulling on him. Why? Because he realizes that, in fact, successive presidents had misled the United States about the Vietnam War and deceived American citizens about the war. Going back to President Eisenhower's work that undermined the Geneva Convention, going back to John Kennedy's deception about sending advisors to Vietnam, exposing the deception of President Johnson and some of his representations to the American people about the war. This study, which is historical in nature, then, according to Daniel Ellsberg, is a story that the American people ought to know about. And so he begins to smuggle out copies of the Pentagon Papers. Mind you, he's not authorized to remove the papers. He's certainly not authorized to make copies of the papers. He's certainly not authorized to smuggle the copies, make copies of them, and share with friendly reporters at the New York Times. So he's doing all of this on the sly. When he contacts friends, old reporter friends at the New York Times, to describe to them that he has this top secret study that describes American involvement in Vietnam and American deception. Would you like to see the papers? Can you imagine asking any reporter, would you like to see a classified story that is going to tell the story of deception about this war that's tearing the country about? Oh, yes, we would. So the New York Times promptly sets up teams of reporters in the fall of 1970 and the winter of 1971 to begin to pore over these pages, 7,000 pages, teams of reporters looking around the clock, trying to decide what is in there, what is the news that fit to print, and of course all the news that is fit to be print, is the time to come up, and how organize these kinds of stories. They work month after month. On June 12th, the Times is ready to go to press with the very first story. On June 12th, the press is rolled. The newspaper is delivered into the city room. The headline is not particularly provocative, just making reference to the availability of this study that describes America's involvement in the war. And when the paper hits the streets, President Nixon is alerted to it by his Attorney General, John Mitchell. And Mitchell immediately tells him, boss, we better go to court and seek an injunction to enjoin, that is, shut down the Times. We don't want these papers to be published because they will imperil America's national security. At that very point, Richard Nixon, who was the sly fox among all the sly foxes, is not particularly bothered by the idea that these papers would be published. Why not? Because it's a historical study. And it describes the acts of deceptions by his predecessors, his opponents, in some cases his enemies, and he is not mentioned in any of the papers. So if, in fact, there will be bad publicity for his predecessor presidents, including Kennedy and Johnson, he doesn't care much. But it's Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State, who, along with the Attorney General John Mitchell, who will persuade Nixon, we need to shut this down. Kissinger's approach to President Nixon is, we need to stop publication of the papers because it will harm our ongoing discussions with the North Vietnamese, and it will undermine our ability to have any kind of confidential discussions or negotiations with other countries, because they'll be fearful that what they say to us will wind up on page one of the New York Times. So Nixon comes around to their view. He tells John Mitchell, go ahead, let's seek an injunction, a court order to stop the press from publishing. The Times is able to publish on the 12th and the 13th, and then the Nixon administration attorneys go to federal court, federal district court in New York City, where they ask Murray Gerfein, an old conservative law and order type, a Nixon appointee, to issue a temporary restraining order, a TRO, and Gerfein promptly issues the temporary restraining order, the injunction. Ladies and gentlemen, the Nixon administration's request to a federal judge to stop the papers from publishing represents the very first time in our entire history that an administration is seeking a court order to stop the press from publishing. The very first time. And when Judge Gerfein issues the injunction, that represents the first time in our history that a court has ever told the newspaper to stop publishing. It sends a chill wind across America because most people recognize that the essential purpose of the First Amendment Free Press Clause, which reads, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press, was designed to prevent prior restraint. Prior restraint was the law in England. It was the law in many countries and prior restraint method. Before you could publish anything in England, for example, a book, a newspaper, a treatise, you would first be required to obtain permission from the crown or from the government. Prior restraint would, of course, chill freedom of discussion. It would mean that the only ideas that would be heard would be those that are amenable to the government. The government would not give its consent to have something published that challenges the official line or the governmental line, and so the scope of freedom of speech would be very, very limited. That's why the framers of our First Amendment Free Press Clause were bent on the idea of ensuring that prior restraint would not apply in America. So when Judge Gerfein imposed the order to stop the presses from publishing, it sent chills up and down the spine of America and those who were concerned about freedom of the press and freedom of speech. Gerfein said to the government, "We'll have a full hearing on these issues at the end of the week, giving you a couple of days to brief the case, make an argument." When that day rolled around, Gerfein refused to grant the government's order to issue a preliminary injunction, but he stayed the publication, the continuing publication of the Pentagon Papers, until the Second Circuit Court of Appeals could hear the appeal from the government. When the Second Circuit heard the argument, it maintained the stay, which is to say, it maintained the prohibition on the Times' ability to publish the Pentagon Papers. So the Times was effectively forbidden by the Second Circuit from publishing. First time, again, in our history that we have a court order to stop the presses. Meanwhile, down in Washington, the Washington Post, only a few days behind the New York Times, begins to publish its first installment of the Pentagon Papers. It does not have as many of the Pentagon Papers as the Times had. The Times, it was assumed, had maybe two-thirds of all the Pentagon Papers. Washington Post, maybe a half. But when the Post learns that the Times has been forbidden from publishing, it feels a greater sense of urgency, and you'll see this depicted in the movie. It feels a greater sense of urgency out of a sense of fraternity among newspapers to quickly publish as long as it's allowed to publish. So the Times can't publish. Here comes its competitor, the Washington Post, gleefully publishing while its superior is prohibited. Times doesn't like that. People at the Washington Post are loving this because the Post had never, up until this point, achieved the kind of recognition or status that had been enjoyed by the New York Times. It was still regarded as something of a small-town newspaper in the nation's capital. But now it becomes a newspaper that's publishing. So what does the Nixon administration do? It quickly goes to court, federal court in Washington, D.C. Judge Gerhard Gissell hears the case. The Nixon administration said impose an injunction to stop the Post from publishing. Judge Gissell says, no, the First Amendment prohibits prior restraint. I'm not going to stop it. So there is the Washington Post publishing. The New York Times is on the sidelines, chewing its fingers. The Times decides to quickly appeal to the United States Supreme Court. The Nixon administration goes to the Circuit Court, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, that has jurisdiction over the federal court in Washington. It brings an appeal. And so very quickly, within 10 days, the United States Supreme Court is prepared to hear arguments on whether or not the Nixon administration has authority to ask the courts to stop publications. This is a case that moves at light speed. As you may know, it often takes 2, sometimes 3 years for a case to move up the judicial pipeline from the federal district court to the Supreme Court. You like that? I'm bringing in some Star Wars terminology, light speed. You see, I go to the movies a little too much. So the court is ready to hear this case, and now the court, at least, is going to hear arguments for why it should hear the case. It's very promising that the court will agree. Why? Because when the Supreme Court decides whether or not to hear appeals from lower courts, one of the, perhaps the principal criterion to persuade the court to hear a case is when the different circuits are in conflict. Different rulings in conflict. And here we have the conflict, right? Because the Second Circuit is prohibiting publication of the papers, while down in Washington, D.C., the D.C. Circuit has permitted publication. So the case is ripe for review. But is this case going to be moved along too quickly, too hastily? Some members of the Supreme Court, as you'll see in a moment, will complain, including the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Warren Burger, who will complain that, in fact, the case is being rushed along. Now, let's think about some of the characters in this landmark litigation for just a second. Arguing the case for the administration, that is the United States, against the New York Times, hence the appeal by the New York Times, so the case of the New York Times versus the United States, because it had lost in the Second Circuit. Arguing for the government's position is the Solicitor General of the United States, Irwin Griswold, who was a legendary figure in legal circles, a longtime dean of the Harvard Law School. He was a giant in legal circles throughout the country. Arguing for the New York Times is a Yale Law School professor named Alexander Bicknell, who was one of America's most prominent constitutional scholars. So as a sideline story, you have Yale against Harvard. Football, Yale people. So you have partisan concerns here. A quick word about Bicknell. We often in America like to talk about men and women of integrity. Bicknell was a man of great integrity. This case, it's going to be argued in June of 1971, came just a year and a half after the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, had told Alexander Bicknell, "I want to appoint you to the Supreme Court. I have a vacancy. You'll be quickly approved by the Supreme Court," because Bicknell, as I say, was known as one of the top two or three constitutional scholars in the country. Certainly, most law professors, most lawyers would not turn down an opportunity to serve on the court. But Nixon had one condition to impose on Bicknell. He said, "I know you're a conservative Democrat, you're a Burkean, you could just as well be a Republican. I want you to change your party affiliation to become a Republican, and then I will nominate you." Now, there might be a lot of people in the country who would change their affiliation for appointment to the Supreme Court, particularly when it doesn't really involve changing their views on policies. It probably would not have been much for Bicknell to change, except for his integrity. He said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I'm not going to change my party affiliation and become a Republican just to serve on the Supreme Court." So another underlying story in this great drama is Alexander Bicknell is now arguing against Richard Nixon, the man that would have put him on the Supreme Court. Pushing all the drama aside for a second, as we said, this case is moving very quickly, and some members of the court are concerned about it, but it was a decision of the justices themselves to hear the case that quickly. So much for the concerns about moving too hastily. This is late June now of 1971. As you probably know, the Supreme Court ends its term officially in June, June 30, and the justices were confronted with a weighty issue. Should we try to hear the arguments now, only days before our term comes to an end? And in case you're wondering, couldn't the Supreme Court just decide to extend its term? The answer is no. Why not? Because Congress, by law, sets the terms of the Supreme Court's term, first Monday in October, ending June 30. The only way that the court could have extended its term, if it had so wished, would have been to make a request to Congress to expand its term. And so there's a long history behind the law that indicates that the Congress has that authority. And so the justices now are wondering, should we hear the oral argument on a very rapid basis, or should we wait until we come back and begin our term in October? Four justices said, let's wait. Those were the justices who did not apparently want the Times and the Post to be able to publish, so they were quite fine if the papers and other papers by now that were starting to publish some of the papers, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Boston Globe, the Detroit Free Press, one or two others, 17 all told. They didn't care if, in fact, the presses would be stopped. But four justices said, no, this is a matter of great urgency. We need to hear the arguments now. The issue came down to Justice Potter Stewart, who was an appointee by Dwight Eisenhower, who saw both sides of the argument. On the one hand, he thought he would likely rule against the right of the newspapers to publish the Pentagon Papers on national security grounds. He was going to be warned to the Nixon argument, essentially. On the other hand, he didn't think it right that the nation should wait, that the papers would have to wait, the newspapers would have to wait. And so as he weighed the different arguments, he decided he was going to vote in favor of a quick argument and a quick resolution of the case. That didn't please his more conservative colleagues on the court. But nevertheless, now the decision was made, oral argument would begin. How quick was this? On a Friday, Chief Justice Burger tells both sides, we are going to go forward. We are going to have oral argument tomorrow, which is Saturday morning, and you need to have your briefs in before we go to oral argument. So 24 hours from now, you have to have your briefs in, and you got to be ready for oral argument. Now, it's not as though both sides were starting from scratch, because remember, they had the chance to make the arguments in federal court in New York, in D.C., and before the circuit courts. But usually, when people are going to brief cases to the Supreme Court, they have many, many months to work on those briefs. So this was going to be working in quick order. The New York Times, led by Alexander Bickel, and a few, Floyd Abrams, one of the nation's foremost First Amendment attorneys, assembled a staff of about 15 attorneys, and they divided up the work. On the government side, here comes Irwin Griswold, the legendary Harvard Law School dean, who had not worked on the case until this point, which is very interesting. Other attorneys inside the Justice Department had been handling the case. So Griswold is at a bit of a disadvantage now. As he will write, he came to the case. He had only ancillary understanding because he'd not been steeped in the case, as other attorneys were. He'd been following it, of course. But now he's going to be on the case, and so he contacts attorneys from the different departments, from state, defense, about a dozen attorneys from the Justice Department, said, I only have time for you to come in here, give me a 20-minute presentation on the leading issues that you think I ought to present in court tomorrow morning. So here he is getting his tutorial from other attorneys, and unfortunately for him, having to swallow the representations by attorneys and accepting them as plausible, accepting them as powerful, accepting them as arguments that he'll make to the court. He does his work, the briefs are filed, the next day, the attorneys parade into court. We've never had a time in American history in which a case was so highly anticipated, except for Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, where the court would hear, of course, the landmark case asking whether or not the 14th Amendment of the United States, of the Constitution, prohibits segregation in public schools. And you know, the court rendered the landmark decision striking down segregation in public schools. After Brown, we have not had a case of such celebrity status, and the Pentagon Papers was even more anticipated only because from the day that the Times first published and the Post first published, it meant that this case was in front of America's eyes for the entire duration. There was no shutting it down. For those of you who may recall the 2000 presidential election, Bush and Gore, and you might have been glued to the television set as millions were, this approximated the way the American people could not free themselves from television, watching the daily tracking of what was going to happen in the ongoing presidential election. So all the newspapers in the country, the networks are ready to cover this, and the newspaper reporters and television reporters are in the courtroom as much as they have room to do so. It's limited seating, and they heard the arguments. Chief Justice Burger called on Griswold first to open the argument to defend the government's position. And he began by arguing, he said, everybody should acknowledge that, in fact, while there is broad protection for newspapers to publish, that there are some circumstances in which the government may forbid newspapers from publishing. In other words, prior restraint is not absolute. There are some exceptions. There are cases in which the government may prohibit newspapers from publishing. And he cites a 1934 case called Muir versus Minnesota, in which the Supreme Court had struck down the state law on grounds of prior restraint, but it said there was an exception. Here was the exception. In that case, Chief Justice Hughes wrote that if a newspaper is going to publish, quote, the sailing time of a troop vessel, and publication of that time will imperil the military mission, then the government may stop the type paper for publishing. So that's called, that's one of those exceptions. The newspapers may not publish the sailing time of the troop vessel because the enemy will know, well, they're coming here at noon, we'll be ready for them. Griswold, in his argument, said, in Muir versus Minnesota, the Supreme Court said that a good example of an exception to the prohibition on prior restraint is the publishing, the publication of the sailing time of a troop vessel. And your honors, this is comparable to that. Publication of these papers will constitute a grave, immediate, and irreparable harm. He's interrupted by Stewart, Justice Stewart, whom you may recall had passed the vote to push forward with the argument, even though he was expected to rule with the government. He says, why are you making this argument to us, Mr. Griswold? The other side has already conceded that there's no such thing as an absolute prohibition on prior restraint. They've already conceded that. They've agreed. You're wasting our time. And this from an ally of the Supreme Court. Griswold said, well, Your Honor, I just came to this case yesterday. I wasn't aware that the other side had conceded that point. One of the problems he had by just coming to the case. So then he goes on to say, but what is really important here is that under our constitutional system, the president has primacy in foreign affairs to make the crucial decisions governing our national defense and our national security. And if the president of the United States believes that publication of these papers will imperil our national security, then the court needs to defer to the president. He was then asked by a Supreme Court justice, well, is there a law on the books that would give the courts the authority to prohibit publication of the papers? No, Your Honor, there is no such law. Well, where does the president derive this power, then, to shut down the press? Griswold said, well, the president has broad, quote, inherent power in the area of national security. This would be the principal argument made by the Nixon administration, that the president of the United States has broad power, broad enough to stop the papers from publishing, even though there's no law to be triggered empowering the courts to stop the presses. This is akin to the old British argument that the Crown has a prerogative power, an inherent power to do what he thinks is best for the nation, and that alarmed a number of justices on the court. Griswold's oral argument didn't go very well, even though he was highly respected. Very few people who had been arguing before the court at that point over 10 or 15 years enjoyed the respect that Griswold did. People referred to him as almost a 10th justice. The Solicitor General of the United States is often accorded a great deal of deference, but Griswold enjoyed even more deference. But in spite of his status, his oral argument didn't go well, in part because he just came to the case. So the court then turns to Bickel to argue the case in the New York Times. And he said, we have a different view of prior restraint, that in this case, publication of these papers is not comparable to publishing the sailing time of a church vessel because this is a historical study. There is nothing here that is going to bring down the country, and I haven't seen anything yet that has brought down the country. And he was a little cheeky. As far as I can see, the Republic is still operating, even though we published a number of installments in the Pentagon Papers. He was chided by one of the unfriendly members of the court for that. But nevertheless, he made his point. And then he challenged the separation of powers argument that was made by Griswold on behalf of President Nixon and said, the president has no inherent power. That's what the framers of the Constitution did away with when they confined the president within Article 2 and rejected the claim that the president would enjoy a king-like prerogative. His argument went back. He had more friends on the court, we would say. At the conclusion of oral argument, then the justices went back to the conference room and very quickly went around the conference, and it was clear that, in fact, the government was going to lose, that the New York Times was going to win. The only question was it going to be a 5-4 decision or a 6-3 decision? It ended up being a 6-3 decision. The three dissenters were Chief Justice Berger, Harry Blackmun, and John Marshall Harlan. The other members of the court agreed that, in fact, the Times and the Post and the others should be able to publish. They had different reasons for doing so. And because of that, because there were many different reasons among the justices, and because of the late time in the Supreme Court's term, the ready-to-leave town, the court issued a per curiam opinion, and that is an unsigned opinion. No justice's name is attached to it. It means an opinion of the court. Sometimes the court will issue a per curiam opinion when the issue is insignificant and the court is not going to spend much time. This is not one of those cases where the issues are insignificant. Rather, it was the fact that the court was out of time. And so they issued the per curiam opinion, which was actually written by Justice Brennan. And if you wonder why did Justice William Brennan write the opinion, because when the Chief Justice is not voting with the majority, then the senior-most justice in the majority, which would have been Hugo Black, decides who will write the opinion, and he assigned William Brennan to write the opinion. And Brennan wrote a very short, this is about a 5-sentence opinion. He said, the assertion of the right to impose prior restraint comes here with a heavy presumption against it. The government bears a, quote, heavy burden to justify the need to impose prior restraint. The government has not met the burden. end of opinion. Every justice on the court nevertheless wrote his own opinion. We had 9 separate opinions, and then some justices worked together with 13 opinions in this case. So when you look at this case, the most passionate opinion, the one more frequently cited than any other opinion, was the opinion written by Justice Hugo Black of Alabama. And Black, who had been an unswerving defender of the First Amendment, of free speech and freedom of the press during his long career, going back to 1937 when he was appointed by President Franklin Roosevelt, writes a very passionate opinion about why the framers of the Bill of Rights inserted the free press clause. And he writes very eloquently that, in fact, the press should not be condemned for publishing the papers, they should be commended. He wrote, this is exactly what James Madison and the founders expected the press to do, to bear the secrets of government, to uncover the deceits of our government and our governmental actors, to, in fact, particularly in a war like this, being fought 8,000 miles from American shores, where American boys, he wrote, are being sent abroad to die of foreign fever and foreign shock. A very eloquent opinion. He goes on to essentially destroy the Nixon administration's argument that the president has primary authority in foreign affairs, denying that the president has inherent power, making the point that without a statute authorizing the courts to stop the press from publishing, the courts are powerless. There's no statute to enforce. What the administration is really doing, Black wrote, is asking the court to create a law to stop the press from publishing, and Black is happy to conduct the tutorial and says, Congress writes the laws, not the courts. It is a very sweet, wonderful opinion, a bow to the historic purposes surrounding the First Amendment Free Press Clause, and it happens to be Justice Black's last opinion. He's already ill at this point. He will die in 3 months, September 17th, which is ironically Constitution Day. And I know you know that because you celebrate it with the enthusiasm that you bring to St. Patrick's Day, I'm sure. Black knew that he was failing. He didn't know he was going to have to leave the institution that he dearly loved. He loved it so much, by the way, that when he proposed to his wife, Elizabeth, after his first wife had died, he said, now, you know, the court is my mistress, and you can never do anything to embarrass me. I need your word. You'll never do anything to embarrass me because that would embarrass the court. So sure, honey, I want you along for the ride, but the court comes first. His wife said to him as she read his draft at 4 a.m, well, honey, if this is going to be your swan song, you've sure written a beauty. And it turned out to be his swan song. That's the opinion of the court that scholars always look at most carefully. There was an opinion written by Thurgood Marshall, who had served as Solicitor General, who had led the NAACP, who had argued and won more cases before the Supreme Court than any attorney in our history, that's called success, who wrote the most efficient opinion and said, we don't need to do anything here except ask the question, is there a statute that would prohibit prior restraint in any circumstances? The answer is no. End of case. End of story. A couple of justices signed on to a concurring opinion in which they said the real standard for determining how we balance freedom of the press against the assertion of national security is to ask, if the stories are published, will they constitute a grave, immediate, and irreparable harm to the United States? That's the standard. Grave, immediate, and irreparable harm. If the stories were not satisfy that very high bar, then there's no justification for prior restraint. The government has not met that burden in this case. And so, as soon as the opinion came down, the editors at the Times and the Post celebrated in a big way. They were happy because they had won this landmark case. All of America won when the Supreme Court upheld the right of the Times and the Post to publish. Why? Because if the Nixon administration had prevailed, it would have set a standard that would allow a president to determine when newspapers may be allowed to publish stories on foreign affairs matters, defense matters, national security matters, and that would have marked the end of freedom of the press on those kinds of areas, and of course that would have undermined our ability as citizens to gather information about what our government is doing when it comes to foreign affairs and national security. And that would have undermined our ability to be good citizens because we would not be in a position to criticize or challenge governmental actions. So it was a huge victory for all of America. But it was not an airtight victory because, remember, the standard going forth was not Justice Black's absolutist view that, in fact, no prior restraints would be permissible. The understanding was there would be some circumstances in which prior restraint would be acceptable. Those situations in which publication of a story might constitute a grave, immediate, and irreparable harm. Now, that's a very high bar, isn't it? But the door remains slightly ajar to some future point when, in fact, an administration might try to stop publication of newspapers or a magazine article. And that's exactly what happened 8 years later in a case involving the Progressive magazine, which was up to a bit of mischief. It was up to being mischievous when it was ready to run an article on how to build your own atomic bomb. The author had gathered enough information, he said, from popular news magazines, but also from governmental literature that was not marked top secret, not classified. Here we would all know how to build the atomic bomb. Before the Progressive magazine went to press, however, they approached the Justice Department and the Department of Defense to say, we've got this, do you have any objections? Of course they did. So they went to court asking for an injunction to stop it. And the court recognized that probably even if the information was not marked top secret or classified, there would be no reasonable person who would say, well, we ought to be able to build our own atomic bombs. The press then was stopped from publishing that story. It was, now the Progressive magazine was appealing, while the case was before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is based in Chicago, the case was dismissed. Why? Because another magazine had published virtually the same article, rendering this case moot. So, if you look far and wide, you can probably acquire the information you need to build your own bomb. But the point is, if that issue had gone forth, if it percolated to the Supreme Court, it's a very good chance that the court might have said, well, yes, this does satisfy the grave, immediate, and irreparable harm test. It could be used for dangerous purposes, for menacing purposes by an administration that does not believe in freedom of the press. On the other hand, it does provide us with a standard of protection against stories being published that might in fact imperil our national security. This case, the Pentagon Papers case then, is one that I've fought many, many times, and it's fought in every civil rights, civil liberties classroom across the country in political science departments and law schools, because it represents one of the greatest issues that we would ever confront in a democracy. How do we balance free speech or freedom of the press on the one hand with our national security needs. Two great values. We don't want to lose sight of either value, and there are some circumstances in which the choice will be very difficult. Here the court decided to exalt freedom of the press because the Nixon administration's objection to the publication of historical papers could not, in fact, meet that standard that it would constitute a great honor. A quick end to this story. You might wonder, whatever happened to Daniel Ellsberg? Because it was Ellsberg, you recall, who had secreted away the Pentagon Papers without authorization, right? Perhaps in violation of the law. What happened to him? After the Nixon administration lost the argument, they went after Daniel Ellsberg. They filed a case in New York federal court to charge him in violation of our espionage statutes. While that case was before the federal judge, however, news broke that the Nixon administration's plumbers unit had been caught breaking into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist in Los Angeles. When the judge got word of this, he lectured the Nixon administration attorney and said, just so you know, under Article 2, the President of the United States has a duty to enforce the law. When he's breaking into offices, he's not enforcing it, he's breaking it. Case dismissed. The Nixon administration was not content to stop. It filed suit in Washington, D.C., and the federal judge, for the same reasons, on the same grounds, dismissed the case against Daniel Ellsberg. So Daniel Ellsberg becomes a hero to many Americans because he had shared word about the Nixon administration's effort to conceal the papers and to deny the American citizenry the information that it richly deserved to better understand our role in the Vietnam War. More than that, like any good American businessman, he went on the lecture circuit to college campuses, made a lot of money. Some of you might have heard him speak. He became a cult figure. I'm going to stop here and see what questions we might have about the Post, the Freedom of the Press, and the Pentagon Papers. Thank you. Thank you very much. Greg Stoddard has the microphone, and he's going to come around so you can ask your questions. For the sake of our radio audience on KISU, let's try to keep our questions short, or at least succinct, if we can. And I'm anxious to hear any questions you might have. Here, Colette, please.
You were saying that they could stop the publication if national security was involved. So who decides whether it's really real or whether it's not?
That's an excellent question. So who really does decide? Well, that's the key question. It's going to be the presidency, the president and his people, someday her people, in what might include the Attorney General, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State. They will discuss whether or not the papers constitute this kind of threat to our national security. Some presidents who might not want publication of papers for out of fear of embarrassment to his policies would want to stop the publication. That wasn't the case for Nixon, remember, because this was a history of the Vietnam War preceding his own presidency. And because Nixon always held grudges against his opponents, in a lot of ways, as scholars suggested, he could gleefully read the stories that were calling out his predecessors for their lies and for their misrepresentations. But for the fact that he was persuaded by Secretary of State Henry Kissinger that, in fact, publication of the papers would undermine our negotiations. But there's no way to prove that future negotiations could be undermined by publication of these papers. No ability to draw a cause and effect relationship between the two. So you raise a very good question, and in many ways, the future of the press, its ability to publish, may hinge on the person in the White House. Is that a person who loves the concept of freedom of the press or has no use for an independent free press? And if it's that sort of a president, then we have to hope that we'll have people who will work through the judicial system, as this case demonstrates, to allow the presses to publish. Thank you. Where are we here, Greg? Please.
Of all the people who had input into the Pentagon Papers, it was Ellsberg who blew the whistle. What was his background?
Excellent question about Daniel Ellsberg. So Ellsberg had been, in fact, a consultant on a number of national security projects over the years, working often for the RAND Corporation, which has a very close relationship with the government, sometimes working in the academic world, but he had always worked primarily in the area of national security. He would later acknowledge, by the way, many years later, that he was one of those younger scholars who had helped to foster the myth during the 1960 presidential election, Kennedy against Nixon, that he had helped to foster the myth that the United States was behind the Soviets in the arms race, thus helping John Kennedy. He would later come clean and say there was no evidence that the United States was being surpassed by the Soviet Union in the arms race. So many years later, he would issue a mea culpa. Ellsberg then would have that kind of career, and then he would be one of the many, many writers of the Pentagon Papers. And of course, then he would see the entire study after he was granted access to it by Nixon, who needed some research done. Over the course of his life, he has remained an outspoken critic of governmental secrecy, calling for transparency. We could liken Daniel Ellsberg to a latter-day Paul Revere. Remember the character in the American Revolution? The British are coming, the British are coming. Well, here he is essentially blowing the whistle on the successive administrations for deceiving the American public about the war. Good question. By the way, on that subject of a mea culpa, before I forget to add this, so I mentioned the name of Irwin Griswold several times, the famed Solicitor General. He went before the Supreme Court, as you know, and said, publication of the Pentagon Papers will imperil our national security. And there might have been, as I say, reasons to believe that he would enjoy extra deference by virtue of his legendary status and the respect, if not deference, often accorded the Solicitor General by the Supreme Court justices. That's in 1971. In October of 1987, 16 years later, Griswold wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post and acknowledged in that op-ed piece, "I had no evidence that publication of those papers would endanger our national security." What if the legendary dean had prevailed in that argument and persuaded the court that publication of the papers would imperil our national security, and the court had prohibited the Times and the Post from publishing? What might our history have looked like? And so it raised a very important ethical question to ask about the Solicitor General. Was he acting inappropriately when he made the argument on behalf of the Nixon administration that, in fact, publication of the papers would imperil our national security? Or was he merely doing his job as the Solicitor General? One way out of his ethical dilemma would have been to resign or refuse to argue the case, right? But it was very interesting that 16 years later he would come clean and said, "I have to say there was no evidence that the publication of the papers would have imperiled national security." Where are we back there? Other questions? Right down here in front. Come on down, Greg. Come on down. We have a prize here. Door number 1, 2, or 3. There we go. Please.
Okay, so you said about the national, if they said there was a national security threat. So all of the people that would come up with that decision are obviously appointed by the president that would want to stifle such a deal. What is there for the courts and us to fight against? Because they can tell us it's national security. They don't even have to prove it. They said, well, there's such security issues, we can't even tell you the security. How does it, what's the countering argument to that?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very important question. So let's turn the clock back just a little bit. In 1944, the Supreme Court heard the case, the Korematsu case, involving the executive order issued by President Roosevelt, supported by a statute enacted by Congress that provided for the forced withdrawal of U.S. citizens of Japanese descent from their homes in California, some 125,000 American citizens being forced from their homes. The argument was made by military officials that, in fact, Japanese Americans might be disloyal, they would engage in espionage, and so on grounds of national security, they said in a report, we better remove those people from the West Coast so that they could not assist the Japanese Navy in attacking the United States. Of course, the legal challenge was mounted, attacking the executive order and the statute on grounds that there had been no evidence that even a single Japanese-American citizen had engaged in espionage, no indication of disloyalty at all. But the administration was arguing to the Supreme Court when the action was challenged that it's grounds of national security. So hence we come to your good question. How can the justices assess a national security claim? Here in Korematsu, unfortunately, in a tragic decision, the Supreme Court bowed to the administration's representation that the withdrawal, the forced ouster of Japanese American citizens had to be upheld because otherwise our national security would be imperiled. In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court upheld the executive order and the statute and the forced ouster. And in that opinion, Justice Black said that he regretted very much that people were being forced out of their homes, that he said war involves hardship, even a collection of hardships, and we all have to endure hardships. Well, it wasn't everybody who was enduring a hardship, 125,000 Japanese-American citizens. It was a case that involved racism, and because we did not force Italian Americans or German Americans, we forced Japanese Americans. At any rate, the point I'm getting to here is that a couple of members of the court said we have no choice but to defer to the administration's representation about national security. The court should defer. Justice Jackson, however, wrote, we don't have to defer without examining the evidence. But the justices found themselves in an excruciating position. If we do not accept the representation made by the administration about national security, and we strike down the program as violating the due process clause, and we allow Japanese Americans to return to their homes, and what if some do engage in espionage, then the court will be blamed for asserting a greater view or vision of national security than the administration, and we're not the experts. So the justices on that premise upheld the program, and it represented one of the great, indeed, tragic moments in our civil liberties history. And because we learned later that the report on which the administration relied was fabricated by two West Coast military officials who harbored deep resentment, indeed, racist resentment toward Japanese Americans, and did not have any evidence that any Japanese American citizen was going to be engaged in espionage or actions against the government, the court became very, very embarrassed. And our government was very embarrassed. So you may know in 1988, Congress passed a reparations bill granting $25,000 to the survivors Not much, because their lives had been destroyed. They had been forced to sell their home for 10 cents on a dollar by those who were cynically exploiting the difficult circumstances of those citizens. Because of that hard lesson, some Supreme Court justices in a case just a few years later indicated that they had made a mistake, and the court was now more sensitive to the argument that it had to defer to the administration, which is why by the time of the Pentagon Papers case, 30 years later, now the justices, as Justice Black pointed out, are not going to engage in an act of obeisance to the administration's representation about national security. In fact, Justice Black wrote, every time there is a desire by the administration to do this or that, they cast the words national security into the conversation as though it's a magical incantation that will end the discussion, but we can't accept that. So the court still struggles with that, and as you know, in the cases since then, particularly after 9/11, when the court had to address several questions involving the attack on America and threats by terrorists, the court is very, very ginger in the way it deals with questions about national security versus civil liberties. It's a very difficult decision. Glad you asked. Where are we, Greg? Right here? Yes, please.
So if I'm the New York Times and I have an article I want to publish that might fall into this realm, what? I can go ahead and publish that article on Sunday and the government finds out on Monday, but there's nothing that says I have to tell them beforehand, is there?
Good question. Very good question. So was the Times required to tell the government we have in our possession the Pentagon Papers? And so should we get your approval or would you like to know we're going to publish? That was one of the points that the administration made, Griswold made, that the government had repeatedly asked the Times for an inventory of the documents that they possess. The Times was not at all considering informing the government. Why not? Because it knew that the government might swoop in and try to grab the papers and remove the papers from their possession, which reminds me that before Daniel Ellsberg was able to deliver all of the papers that he would deliver to the Times, he moved those papers around, went to friends' houses to stay the night. He was on the run for 13 days in Boston. That sounds like a movie. On the run for 13 days, never sleeping at home because he feared that that the FBI would crash his house, take his papers. So did the Times have an obligation to inform the government? It's a very interesting question because historically, the Times on other occasions had cooperated with the government on involving the Bay of Pigs crisis, for example, the U2 crisis. That's not the musical group. That was the spy plane. So it's a difficult, delicate question for newspapers to decide if they're going to try to cooperate with the government or if they're going to go full speed ahead. But in this case, as you point out, the Times started publishing on a Saturday. Within 2 days, the administration was ready to try to grab the papers. One other point on this. When the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, it would have to accept possession of the papers from the lower court that first heard the argument, which would mean the federal district court in New York, Judge Gerfein, right? And so the judge, any kind of record would be transferred to the Supreme Court from that court. But Gerfein had to say to the Supreme Court, I'm willing to send the papers. I cannot guarantee their safety, precisely because the whole country was up in arms about them. So what to do? So the Pentagon had a copy and under armed escort protected the transfer of the papers from the Pentagon to the United States Supreme Court. Such were the concerns about safety and the possession of the New York Times papers and the Washington Post. So interesting story. Any other questions down here? In the back. Let's go over there and then back here. I think Dawn has a question, please.
I'm not even quite sure how to phrase this question, but we're talking about times when paper evidence was a big deal. And I'm just wondering how the internet and the instantaneous nature of publishing on the internet factors into these preemptive court rulings.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So it was different in the old days when everything was on paper, right? But the world has changed, and now everything is on a laptop or a computer, except those things that aren't. The Clinton administration learned a hard lesson after the president went through the impeachment process, and they tried to delete a lot of emails. From that point forward, entering the years of the Bush administration, George W., the word was, don't write anything down anymore. Well, that's a problem for us in terms of holding governmental officials accountable. If nothing's on paper and nothing's on email and nothing's on the computer, how do you hold people accountable? But more importantly, how do governmental officials conduct their business, and where's the transparency if everything is done by word of mouth? When emails are still available, and we now know they are available because Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation has yielded a huge treasure trove of emails, we would say, of governmental officials inside the Trump administration and those who worked on the campaign who had decided to do business with email. And, of course, this is leading to charges of obstruction, among other charges. So what happens if we have emails that lead to a case of prior restraint? Probably the court's ruling is still going to be the same. That is, the standard will still be the same, whether it involves grave, immediate, and irreparable harm. But what are you stopping from being published if it's just an email, right? There's nothing to be stopped. And that's why, without a paper trail, we can express alarm as to how the people's business is conducted if it's just conducted in conversations. Come over to the Oval Office, for example. Let's discuss whether to push the trigger, to push the button. Paper trails have always been important for us to understand the historical decision-making process, as it was in the case of the Vietnam War and so many other areas. Where are we, Greg?
Please. Hi, David.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is a question within your bailiwick, but so Ellsberg was. He did something wrong. He knew that, you know, because of his position, his job, he knew that he could not release that information. But if you look at it from a person receiving that isn't working with classified or in that realm, if they just get that, do you know what their obligations are to do or not do? And would the press have the same obligations to do or not do?
Yeah. That's a good question. It dovetails with your question in a number of ways. The first question is, the reporters might say, am I in possession of this material legally? Did you have the authority to give it to me? But what if the newspaper doesn't ask that question? What if it just assumes that if Mr. Ellsberg gave us these materials, he must have the authority to do so? Now, are the lawyers at the Times advising the publisher not to publish? In fact, at the New York Times, the attorneys, at least before the arguments began, were attorneys from a very prestigious New York firm, Lord & Day. And they argued that possession of the papers and certainly publication of the papers constituted treason. Don't publish them. You'll go to prison if you do, an important theme in the movie The Post as well. And so when the New York Times owner and editors refused to accept the advice of the attorneys. The attorneys withdrew as the firm representing the New York Times, which is pretty significant when you think of big clients and prestigious clients. They dropped, Lord and Day didn't want to represent the Times anymore because they believed they had the obligation to tell the government we're in possession of the papers. Well, that's what raises the important issue. Remember, Justice Black said that the founders expected the government to bear, the founders expected the newspapers to bear the secrets of government and to expose deceit. In other words, get in there and find out what you can because you have a fundamental informing duty. Your principal responsibility is to inform the American people. And that's represented in our familiar characterization of the Free Press Clause as, quote, the people's right to know. That's how the founders viewed the Free Press Clause, as the people's right to know. So as Black wrote, quoting Thomas Jefferson, the press works for the people, for the governed, not the government. So what is the obligation? If you tell the government we're in possession of these papers, then you may have to release those papers and we'll be deprived of the very valuable history that the Pentagon Papers told to the American people and enabled us to better understand the ways in which governmental officials make the decisions. And, of course, we came to understand the deceit, which made us a little more cynical. And we're always fond of saying that as a combination of the Vietnam War and Watergate, America lost its innocence. That's the familiar refrain. Follow up.
Just a little follow up. So the Times had legal representation that should know, all right, whether the Times and the lawyers agree or not. So I'm thinking, and this goes into the idea of printed press and now the Internet, somebody gets a box of something, you know, papers from the government, and reads through it, and they're writing a blog. Well, they probably don't have a legal firm behind them or, you know, to inform them. So it seems like part of the law is that you have to have the reasonable right to know that what you're doing is wrong, you know, to not do it. So how would that go in today's modern blogosphere and the electronic press?
I appreciate that. Even if there is the question of illegal possession, because the papers or the materials were procured through illegal means, what's the duty of the press? To publish so as to inform the American people, even if there are laws perhaps prohibiting the publication of the papers? If it were the case that the press always followed those laws prohibiting publication or acquisition of the materials, we would know a lot less than we do about the deceptive actions of our governmental officials over time. And so there's a higher end here. What if, for example, Congress, we had a cranky Congress that passed 1,000 laws prohibiting publication of this, that, and everything, or acquisition of materials in this way and that way, to the point where the press would be starved for information, which would mean we would be denied information about the actions of our government. That's what Black is saying. There is a historic purpose behind enshrining the Free Press Clause in the First Amendment, fully protected by First Amendment protection. It works as an adversary to our government. Presidents don't like it that the press has had an adversarial relationship with presidents of both parties for many years. We just have a different relationship these days between President Trump and the press because he's very antagonistic toward the press, characterizing it as the enemy of the people, right? We've had other presidents who have been very disappointed in particular stories, but none, at least publicly, who have said they're enemies of the people. And so that historic purpose behind the Free Press Clause, written by James Madison and the boys, serves a very, very important function in a democracy. It's not always going to be one that's consistent with the motives or the aims of those in power. Makes for a good movie, you might say. We're just about out of time. And down here, please, Greg, we have a question. Yeah.
When it comes to the media, the White House and the president, when they try to discredit them or, in some cases, prevent them from publishing, do you think that when they do this, they have a long-term effect when it comes to the media's reputation?
That's a very good question. If we look at this tug of war, this pushing and pulling, we would have to hope that in the long run that the press will win. Only because it serves great democratic purposes, only because it serves the historic functions outlined in the First Amendment. Some presidents are going to win the battle against a press with which he has an antagonistic relationship. And I think that's what we're witnessing now. If we put this current relationship between President Trump and the press into this context and wonder who will prevail, I'd say the jury's still out, because we've never had a president who has consistently assailed the press, not just attacking specific stories, there's plenty of that, but engaging in demagoguery to demean and to dismiss the press as purveyors of false news, as enemies of the people. If you bring down the press, you bring down a principal pillar upholding our democracy. Our republic hinges on the strength of a free press. It's inconceivable that we could have a democracy without a free press. Inconceivable because an independent press is necessary to provide information to the people so that we can be knowledgeable participants. If we're left merely to the machinery of the White House, any White House, to provide us with information, we're not likely to get the straight stuff. History demonstrates that those in power want to put spin on the information that the people will acquire, so because controlling information is real power. Knowledge is power. Alexander Pope said, information is power. And we can see this in an episode that occurred on October 25, 1983, when President Reagan decided to invade the tiny island of Grenada because he said American medical students were threatened. The important part of the story for us with respect to that small battle is to be found in the fact that when President Reagan ordered the attack, that he told the press, we don't have room on the ships to carry or ferry reporters, so you can't come on this one. You can't cover this event. Well, that was shocking because the press has been present at every significant military battle in American history going back to the Revolutionary War. We have not had a president until that point who would have prohibited the press from covering an invasion. And, of course, President Reagan's rationale was pretty lame when he said, we don't have room on the ships. Why lame? Because some enterprising reporters had been able to secret their way on the island, hiring some independent navigators. And when the American military found the press there, they removed them from the island and somehow found room on those same ships to ferry them away. So there was an episode then in which the president was trying to impose a blackout on the news so that the administration could spin the nature of the invasion and how it went. Imagine therefore, if any president, Democratic or Republican, could in fact black out the press and deny the American people information necessary to evaluate any particular episode. That would be very dangerous. It would be a menace to our democracy. I think we have a question down here, please, Greg. This will be the last question, I'm afraid, because we're out of time here. Well, we'll take three from you, one here. Yes, please.
So in modern days, how can the Supreme Court make any ruling on press when documents are taken, given to a different journalistic entity that's not in the United States, and then released, like in Edward Snowden's case?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very good question. First of all, no court would have a chance to render a ruling until a case is brought. And in order for a case to be brought involving a free press claim, we're going to have some news organization in the United States that is publishing material that the government doesn't want published in order to start the lawsuit, right? If, in fact, documents are removed from the United States and published in a foreign newspaper, a foreign outlet, it makes it very difficult for us to evaluate the free press claims when it doesn't involve an American newspaper or an American magazine. We will still have claims. I don't doubt that. I just sense that there will be lawsuits that are perpetrated by the administration trying to stop the press or magazines from publishing. And I don't know how serious President Trump is when he says our libel laws are quote-unquote weak and we need to change the libel laws so it's easier for a president, as he put it, to defend himself against fake news. Well, we don't have time to go into the libel law involving at least public officials, but I can tell you that it's very difficult for a president to bring a suit against a newspaper when he feels that he has been libeled. And another New York Times case, New York Times versus Sullivan in 1964, the landmark decision, an opinion written by Justice Brennan, held that the only possibility for a governmental official to sue a newspaper would be is if he can prove, he or she can prove, reckless disregard of the truth with a malicious intent. That's a very high bar. It's almost impossible, it seems to me, for a president to be able to sue a newspaper on those grounds. But you've just opened a great question that could lead to another episode in another week. Thank you very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. Thanks to KISU. We'll rebroadcast. And remember, I hope you'll all join us next week so we can watch the State of the Union address. Since it begins at 7 o'clock, please come by 6:45 so you can get a good seat and watch the two flat-screen TVs. I'll comment on President Trump's comments.